About 66 AD, the Roman government got tired of Israel and Jerusalem and the people there. They got tired of their refusal to speak Latin. They got tired of their things about images. They got tired of the fact that they were always in some kind of insurrection. They were always fighting. They were always, every year at Passover, they had to send in an extra army in order to be able to keep the peace in that region of the world. They had it, they've had it, they've had it, and they decided to do something about it. And so in 70 AD, the Roman army arrived and squashed Jerusalem and Israel. They just flattened it. They decided that this center for worship, this temple that was the cause of all the problem, they had to come down. And so they said they were going to reduce it so that there was not one stone left upon another. And that's what they did. It's gone. They took it down. And there is nothing left today except the retaining wall on the side of the mountain. That's the Wailing Wall. That's all that's left of the temple that Herod the Great built. As they came into town and they destroyed all this, then they wanted to expand their destruction. They wanted to get all of the Jewish people and send them out of there, get them out of town so that they couldn't do anything. Down a couple days' journey away, next to the Dead Sea, there is a place called Masada. Masada is a fortress. It's a fortress that Herod the Great built, and it's on top of a mountain, and a red-topped mesa. You can see that it would be pretty hard, at least in those days, to get up to the top of that, except that there is one trail up the side of the mountain. The 1,000 Jewish people, men, women, and children, were living on top of that mountain, but the Romans didn't want them in their back pocket. They wanted them out of there. So what they were going to do is they were going to force them, they were going to take this mountain. But that trail is built in such a way that it is easily defendable. One archer could sit at the top and defend against the entire Roman army. There's no way they could do that. So the Romans had to figure out another way. And what they ended up doing was they ended up building a ramp of dirt. It took them 3 years to build this ramp. Now think about it. And we're sitting here in a desert. This, if they have 10 or 15% humidity, it's a very wet day. Notice any springs on top of that water? Do you see a waterfall anywhere? They didn't have any water. So how did these 1,000 Jews live for 3 years with the Romans surrounding them and keeping them from going anywhere and doing anything, let alone food? How about water? Where did they get it? Well, Herod, who built this because he was paranoid and he thought that everybody was out after him and this was his fort to get away from those who were going to kill him, Herod had such an ingenious system of cisterns that collected water. Israel has a brief rainy season, and during that season, these cisterns under the ground there would take in the water. They would fill full of water. And every year, the people of Israel, the people that were sitting on top of this mountain, had more than enough water for themselves, their animals, and their crops. Now, you can't say that for the Romans downstairs, down on the ground. They were down there, and like I said, it was very low humidity. And so they needed lots of water. And if you look down over the edge, if you get up the edge of this thing and you look down today, you can see the outline of the camps. They were there for 3 years. And so they left their imprint that is visible 2,000 years later. They left their imprint in the desert. And from each one of these camps all the way around Masada, there are trails that come together and go off to the north to En Gedi, which is the water supply. The Romans had to go get their water. They had to truck it in. The Jews had it provided by God. Now, eventually the Romans do win. They build this ramp and they kill off all the Jews on the top of the mountain. Well, actually, the Jews kill themselves off rather than submit to the Romans. They kill themselves. But the Romans finally and ultimately win. But they were held off because of this unique cistern system to provide water. Because water is necessary for all of life. Last year when we went to Israel, one of the places that we stopped in was Gordon's Calvary. Lieutenant General Gordon was a British general after the First World War, living in Jerusalem and part of the occupation force. And he was sitting on the wall of the city of Jerusalem, and he looked out across this place and he saw this hill. And if you kind of look at it, if you look at it a little like this, you can see two eyes and a nose, and maybe down at the bottom down there some teeth. Kind of looks like a skull. 2,000 years ago, it even more looked like a skull than it does today. Or 100 years ago, it looked more like a skull than it does today. And 2,000 years ago, it really looked like a skull. And he got to looking at that thing, and he says, you know, Golgotha is the place of the skull. Maybe this is Golgotha. Maybe this is the place where Jesus was crucified. So he went over there, and he started looking around, and a stone's throw away from this mountain, this hill, he found a garden. And in that garden, he knew it was a garden because in that garden, there was a cistern underground in that garden. Go ahead. And you can see how big it was. That ladder has, what, 1, 2, 3, 4 people on it, and there's room in between each one of them, and there's still more. So it's 24. It's about 40 feet deep by 40 feet wide. I don't know what the cubic measurements of fluid would be. But they had to have these cisterns because water was critical. They could not count on it being there every year. Droughts happened. And so they had to have a way to keep things, keep water so that they could continue. If they didn't have the water, they were going to die. This is nothing new. There's nothing unusual. We got to have the water. And this was their way of doing that. A couple years ago, 92 or something like that, I took the family and we went out to the far west to see the sites. One of the places we went was the Navajo Indian Reservation, and it looked something like this. This is one of the pictures that I took. This is the Navajo Indian Reservation. You can see the red top mesas, and they're all over the place. We got there early in the afternoon, and we were thinking about driving. They have a road, what they call a road, it's not. They have a road that goes back into the area, and you can go in and you can see all these different mesas and do your own thing. About the time we were debating whether or not we should pay for a tour or go in on our own, and we were kind of broke back then, this guy with a pickup truck comes pulling, not a pickup truck, a hook truck, tow truck, there we go, got the right word. A tow truck comes out with this great big huge Buick. I remember it was a Buick. I don't know, you know, why, but it was a Buick. This tow truck is bringing the Buick out, and the guy told us, well, he went in there by himself and broke his axle. So we decided we're not going to do that. So we hired this Indian, an older gentleman, and he had a high reach, four-wheel drive van, and we were the only people in the back of this 15-passenger van. And he took us out into the reservation. And as we were going along, we were talking a little bit, and he asked me where I was from, and I said, we're from Florida. And he kind of looks at me over his shoulder, and with a very wistful expression, he says, there's a lot of water in Florida, isn't there? And the only thing I could say, yeah, but, you know, this is beautiful too. A little later on, he showed us what he called the watering hole for the horses. In the reservation, there was this watering hole. You and I, we'd call it a mud hole. That's how much water was in it, just enough barely to make some mud. And that was their watering hole. Water is important. It's critically important. And we have wars over water all the time. Again, in the time of it, right now in Jerusalem, in Israel, the Jordan River comes out, is fed from Lebanon down into the Sea of Galilee, and then from the Sea of Galilee down to the Dead Sea. That Jordan River is the water for it, is being contested between Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, Israel. All of them want a piece of that water. All of them want a piece of what's going on there. In fact, they want so much of that water now for irrigation and for drinking water and all the rest of that stuff, that the Dead Sea is dying. Now, it's hard to be a Dead Sea and die, but what keeps the Dead Sea there is the water coming down the Jordan, runs down to the Dead Sea and stops, and it is evaporated. That's what makes it so salty and so thick and so deadly. But even the water coming down the Jordan is not making it. And so the Dead Sea is evaporating. And more and more and more land becomes available around the Dead Sea. And the water gets further and further away from the beach. You know, they used to go swimming there. At En Gedi, there was a beach. And you could go out and you could float. You got out and you sat down in the water and boing, just floated because it was so dense. There is water wars between Nevada and California and Mexico over the Colorado. There is wars in between Alabama and Georgia and Florida over the Apalachicola. There is a war between Georgia and Florida over the Suwannee, the water coming out of the Okefenokee Swamp. Remember a couple years ago when Georgia was so dry? Atlanta was having a real bad time. The Chattahoochee River was drying up. The reservoir was almost gone. The Lake Lanier was three-quarters empty. They discovered that the surveyor who had plotted the original line between Georgia and Tennessee had made a mistake, and he had gone a little further south than he was supposed to. And that if he had gone where he was supposed to, a piece of the Tennessee River would have dipped down into Georgia. And if Georgia now owns that little loop of the Tennessee River, they could put a straw in it and suck it dry. Never went anywhere, but they sure are looking forward to having some of that water. Water is critical. Water is a desperate reality of life. Water is what people need and desire. You'll die of lack of water a lot quicker than you die from lack of food. We need it. We've got to have it. Okay, all of that is to set us up for what's going on in the Old Testament. And the Old Testament reading from Isaiah, God is saying that if you will be obedient to me, if you will do these things, the things that I'm laying out here for you, if you'll do what I've asked you to do, then I will provide your greatest need. I will give you what you want more than anything else in this world. I will make you like a well-watered garden. We will be like the plants on this side, well-watered, instead of the ones on this side that need some water. God is saying that he is going to give us everything that we possibly need, like a well-watered garden. All our dreams will be fulfilled if we are obedient to what we have already agreed in our baptism to do. He's not asking us to do something brand new. He's just asking us to do what we already agreed to do. If we are obedient to his will, we will be like a well-watered garden. This is not a bribe. This is not some kind of dog treat where you do a trick and you get your reward. In fact, we have a choice. We have a choice between doing God's way and receiving what God has already given to us. He's already there waiting for us. All we have to do is go that way and get it. Or we can go the world's way and miss out on everything that God wants us to do. Now, the people of Israel, what they wanted more than anything else was water. And so water here takes on the symbolic place of that which is most important to you. Water was important to them. What's important to us? Well, you think about it, pretty much the same stuff. Physically, we need water and food and shelter and security. They wanted peace, and so do we. But spiritually, it's the same too. They were looking for a sense of assurance. They wanted to know that they could trust God to come through for them. It was not like the guy who came to the farmer. It was the example of what oxymoron is all about. You know what an oxymoron is? Something that is internally inconsistent, it just doesn't fit together. This guy came to the farmer and said, I'm from the government, I've come to help. It's an oxymoron, just doesn't work that way. We want to be able to know that we can trust God. We want to know that there's a future, that life is not just today and tomorrow, that there is more to that, we can make some sense out of this world, that there is some reason to believe that we can make some sense out of the chaos of life, and that ultimately there is a solution to the problem that we have. We want to know that this life is not all that there is, that this is not just existence, but there is more, and that we're not alone, lost as in the vastness of multiple universes going on and on and on. We want to know that God is there among us and with us and beside us. We want peace in our soul. We don't want to be at war with God. Think about it. At war with God. That's not a very good thing. We don't want to be at war with God. We don't want to have to stand before Him and justify what we have done. We want to know that we are forgiven. We want grace, love that we don't deserve but desperately need. We want to know that we have been forgiven, that we don't have to carry the burden anymore. Several years ago when I was down in South Florida, I was, and I don't remember why I was in Wellington. It was about 30 miles north of where I was living, but we were in this town of Wellington, southeast coast of Florida, very well-to-do. That's where they have a polo patch. And King or Prince Charles and his friends, they come and play polo once a year or so. That's the kind of community this place is. And as I was pulling in, it was about 7 o'clock in the morning as I was coming into town. And I stopped at this light, and this kid, and a bunch of them, but this one particular one and caught my attention. He was on his way to school, and you could tell because he had this backpack on. You know what I'm talking about, a big old backpack? It covered his entire back, and it stuck out from him about 2 feet. And he was walking with it like this, okay? And he had a French horn in his hand. We want to get rid of the burden. We want to find a sense of forgiveness so that we're not on the outs with God or with other people. We want to know that we are right with God. That's what's important to us. And God is saying that if we are obedient, then the things that we desire most in life are waiting for us just around the bend. All we have to do is go get them. God is saying that we are being obedient. In the scripture, He's saying that we're being obedient when we treat people as the children of God. When we treat people not as things to be used for our convenience, but when we treat them as human beings, when we treat them as people who need to hear the good news of Jesus Christ, as we treat them as people who are valuable, someone for whom Jesus Christ died. God is saying that we are being obedient when we live honorable lives, when we don't cheat one another, when we don't cheat our boss with our time, when we don't cheat our employees with their paycheck, when we don't cheat the people who serve us. We need to live honorable lives and not lives and not lie just for the fun of it or to promote ourselves against everybody else. He's saying we're being obedient when we share with others out of the abundance of what we have. We give the things that they need desperately: food, shelter, clothing, water, security. Simply because we have them and they don't. God is saying that we're being obedient when we follow God's lead, when we listen to Him, when we submit ourselves to God's will and listen. Not just hear, but really listen and then do something about what we have heard. To actually do something about what God is calling us to be and do. So that we can be His people, to live a life that rejects, that reflects God, so that the world will know that we're not hypocrites, but we are children of God. After all, He did it. He led by example, right? He sent his only begotten son, Jesus Christ, so that we could follow him. We could understand what it means to be a child of God by following Jesus Christ. You want to know what God looks like? Look at Jesus. You want to live a life, a godly life? Look at the life of Jesus. God has said to us that we have a choice. We can go our own way, do our own thing, be our own boss, take care of ourselves and watch out for ourselves, and we're going to end up with a life that is ultimately disastrous. A life that is short and self-centered and full of pain and sorrow that will not go away. Or we can choose to be obedient and discover a life of grace and meaning and purpose. A life that supports and cares for one another, that gathers everyone together and gives us a life that lasts for all eternity. Abundant, shaken down, pouring over, pressed down, one with God. The choice is yours.